Thank you. Thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to do anything having to do with reason, among other things, because it's called reason. I mean, who could be against that? It's like Institute for Justice, which is also, I think, has many connections to reason, is an excellent, excellent public interest law firm. And what a name. Everybody's for justice. Everybody should be, I think, for freedom of speech on campus. And probably when you ask people if they are, probably the great bulk will say they are. You know, there are always some buts. And I have to say, you know, there ought to be some buts. There are some limits on free speech. I'd be happy to talk about it a little later on. The interesting thing is just how substantial the limits have become in recent years, especially in the minds of some, including many, many university administrators. But I'm going to start with an email that I just got, I think, day before yesterday. And it's from a UC Santa Cruz student. So I get this email I got about a week ago. I'm a UC Santa Cruz first-year student working on a project about hate speech for my rhetoric and inquiry writing class. What happens is if you search for hate speech, you're going to find an article, or it's pretty likely you're going to find somewhere in the top of the Google results an article that I wrote on the blog about how there's no hate speech exception to the First Amendment. And in fact, hate speech is not even a legal label. It's not something that has any real legal significance. There's no definition of it, at least in American law. So he starts out by saying, I think making an exception to the First Amendment can be beneficial to prevent hate speech because the Supreme Court can interpret what applies as hate speech and therefore prevent discrimination whenever it is necessary. Why do you think that not banning hate speech as it currently stands is not going to accomplish this? So note a couple of things going on here. One is he didn't actually give me a definition of hate speech. That's one of the things that often happens with a lot of these terms, hate speech, harassment, microaggressions, various other such things. Often they're not defined. They're just assumed to be bad, assumed to be something we need to ban. And the devil, turns out, in a lot of things is in the details. You could have something that even if people accept as a matter of principle, and I don't in this instance, but even if you do accept as a matter of principle that something may be a subject potentially for regulation, you'd want to ask, how do you define it? At least that's what lawyers think. But often advocates of this don't say that. They say, leave it to the Supreme Court. An interesting question is why the very same people who fault the Supreme Court and other institutions for being racist, sexist, oppressive, establishment institutions, why they think that in this situation it's worth delegating it such power. But the other thing is prevent discrimination wherever it is necessary. It's just sort of an assumption. We've got a goal, we've got a purpose, and that's enough for everything else to fall beneath it. So preventing discrimination, well, that's so important, it's okay to restrict speech, it's okay to restrict anything. This is nothing new, right? If you look at the early free speech cases, the early speech restrictive cases from the Supreme Court in the 19-teens, 1920s, you see that except the goal is fight the war, fight World War I. And I asked him in response, I haven't heard back an answer yet, I said, why do you think preventing discrimination is so important to justify restricting free speech, and you think that the courts, once they accept that, wouldn't say, well, preventing attacks on police officers is important enough to justify restricting anti-police speech or something along those lines. But then it goes on, if hate speech is not yet a solution to prevent hate-motivated behavior and discrimination, what do you think can be a solution to prevent this? So this is the don't just stand there, do something mode of policy argument I run into a lot of times in gun policy debates. And I heard somebody articulate as a principle, one, don't just stand there, do something. Two, this is something. Three, therefore we should do it. But then I think it really, the dead giveaway is in the last sentence. Because the current laws in the U.S. do not seem effective. We still have Donald Trump and the likes of him spreading hate, and it is working. Now, I am not a fan of President Trump. I have to say I've started viewing him a little bit more positively once I've seen some of what his enemies have been doing and saying. But I did not vote for him. I am quite skeptical of many of his policies. I I think there you could argue, actually, that there may be flaws in a political system in which somebody could be elected without having had any really extensive prior political experience. Maybe we went too far with shifting from the smoke-filled rooms to the primary process. Interesting questions. But this isn't what this guy is after. He actually wants to stop people from backing Trump. He wants to stop Trump from saying certain things. And this is the way I think it invariably happens. People start out by saying, when you ask them to define hate speech, well, the hate speech is just incitement to genocide. It's incitement to violence. All right, fine. Well, okay, that sounds very bad. Oh, yes, and it's what Donald Trump is saying. So really, that's what they're, if they want to suppress what got Trump elected, if they want to suppress what Trump is saying, the bans on so-called hate speech are essentially bans on criticism of any policies that the people think are the policies that are worth having. Criticism of illegal immigration. Criticism of extremist Islam. Criticism of Islam more generally. That's the sort of stuff that they're trying to suppress. So I found this email very telling. But having said so, I've got to acknowledge this is an email from a first-year student in college. So you could say, well, this is just an outlier. The whole point of having people go to college is maybe they'll learn something. And, you know, UC Santa Cruz is not a bad university by any means. But the fact that one freshman at UC Santa Cruz says such things doesn't really tell us that much. So all right, if this were all, then I'm not sure that this would be much. But I think by the end of this talk, I think you'll find that the view of many people with much more education and much more power than this one student is something very, very similar. And this is something that that happened at a top 20 law school involving the moot court program. Now, how many people here are trained as lawyers? Okay, so not that many, but you may have heard of moot courts. Moot courts are moot court programs, excuse me, at law schools. The phrase means various different things. But moot court programs at law schools are programs in which students are given a problem. Often the problem includes the package of all of the cases that they're supposed to be relying on. So it's not a research problem. It's a writing problem, and it's an oral advocacy problem. So you're given, the research is done for you, and you're supposed to write a brief and then argue from the brief. And then you are evaluated, and eventually there is a finals round of the moot court, which often has real judges judging it. It's an important part of education for many students. It's usually run by student groups, but not infrequently with some degree of faculty participation and faculty kind of final sign-off, which actually makes a lot of sense, because if the students are designing a problem, and they just don't realize that there are difficulties with the problem, like some students will misinterpret something, or they will end up, some people will interpret it one way, some another way, and then it becomes very difficult to grade the briefs against each other. You want to have somebody who's actually an experienced lawyer and law teacher provide some evaluation. So that's the way moot courts run. And at this school, that is exactly the way the moot court was run. And the other thing is that traditionally, moot courts are set up with a constitutional law issue at the heart of it, usually one that's pending before the U.S. Supreme Court. That's just something of custom, but it's also a way of making students extra excited about the problem. So about 2 years ago, there was a case pending before the Supreme Court called Elonis, and it involved threats. Now, I mentioned at the outset, you know, everybody does think there's some limits on free speech, or maybe not in this room, everybody, but most people do. And one of the limits is for threats, that if somebody threatens to kill me, that is generally seen as punishable speech, because threats are seen as very likely to be coercive in some ways, but even if not, they're distressing, but distressing in a way that we really appreciate why it's distressing and think it should be stopped. But of course, then the question is how you define a threat. And one of the issues that arises, and this is an issue that lawyers and judges work into a lot of contexts, is what's called the mens rea, or guilty mind, the mental state required for something to be a threat. So it turned out that in 2003, the Supreme Court, in a case called Virginia v. Black, which involved cross-burning, it stated that to be a punishable threat, something has to have the purpose of threatening, has to be intended to threaten. Other courts at the time had said, no, it's enough if a reasonable person would perceive it as threatening. So there's a subjective standard versus objective standard, purpose versus negligence. It's the sort of thing that lawyers love to argue about and actually makes a non-trivial difference potentially in trials, and especially in criminal trials. The Supreme Court seemed to say it was purpose, but it didn't really explain itself. And there were all these cases that said the mental state had to be negligence, and it wasn't clear that it was trying to overrule those cases. So it's one of those things where Supreme Court makes a decision, resolves some questions, which Virginia v. Black did, leaves open others or creates others for the future. Perfect moot court territory, seemed to the students. But then one of the administrators told them, you can keep the problem, but you have to exclude Virginia v. Black from the course pack, from the research package. Why, they ask, that this is Hamlet without the prince, right? This case, Alonis, is only before the court because Virginia v. Black had created some ambiguity. What's more, there are only two Supreme Court cases, an earlier, very brief case called Watts and Virginia v. Black, that are at all bare on the true threats exception. How can we exclude one of them? And the administrator said, you need to exclude it because it's about cross-burning, and some Black students might be offended. Now, this is not a case about the wonderful things about cross-burning, right? It's not like maybe Plessy v. Ferguson from 1896 not being just about segregation but affirming segregation, even if that's so. If it's part of the precedence that you need to talk about, you need to talk about it. No, this is a case about people being criminally prosecuted for cross-burning. Well, no, this itself, just a mere fact pattern alone, is enough to make students upset. So they say, okay, fine, but even if we exclude Virginia v. Black, we have to include some other cases. So we'll include circuit court cases, appellate cases that talk about this. But naturally, all of those cases cite Virginia v. Black, and all of them have little parentheticals saying what the facts of Virginia v. Black were. And the administrator said, no, we've got that covered. You need to black out those parentheticals. Now, this is what I call, this is a special case of what I call the March of the Living Straw Man. If 10 years ago I had presented this as an example of the problems with some of the attempts to restrict speech and academic freedom on campuses, people would have said, that's ridiculous. This is a ridiculous straw man. Like, let's talk about what's really likely to be restricted and not stuff that you just make up that nobody would dream of restricting. And yet here they are. All right. So I'll tell you, there's a happy ending. After four administrators all took the same view, the students complained to a faculty member. The faculty member complained to yet a fifth administrator. Turned out it was the right administrator. Within 2 days, the policy was reversed. And I should say, there was no evidence that any Black students who actually then saw the problem had any objection to it. So this is the cover of a book put out by two people at the Ayn Rand Institute. And the book is Failing to Confront Islamic Totalitarianism. And when I talk about this in other audiences, I explain what Ayn Rand Institute, I don't feel I need to explain this here. This was at a panel that the Ayn Rand Institute and the Federalist Society put together a little over a month ago at UCLA Law School. And the panel was, the main speaker was Fleming Rose, the Danish editor who was involved in the original publication of the Muhammad cartoons. He was speaking about freedom of speech. But outside of the event, the Ayn Rand Institute had a table where they were selling books. Now, I should say, turns out apparently that is not allowed under a policy that the university has, that if any outside group wants to sell anything, they need to have permission. And in principle, at least it's a defensible policy for the university controlling what is, after all, its property, in part because if you sell things, you have cash. usually. And if you have cash, there actually is risk of theft, risk of trouble. And if there is such a policy and there is such a rule and the rule is enforced in a content-neutral way, so for example, they just say, okay, fine, you want the permission, we'll give you the permission, but tell us how much cash is involved, tell us how you're going to secure it, is it going to be in a place where there's a sort of high traffic and maybe high risk of theft or low, who knows what. So they may have been in violation of this policy. But nobody said anything about this policy to them with regard to the book. Instead of an administrator, or at least at the outset, instead an administrator came with these four books. He said, this book, you have to not stop selling. You have to take it down altogether. Why? Because its title is inflammatory. Now, yes, talking about Islamic totalitarianism is inflammatory enough in university campuses that you're not allowed to display a book at a university. Again, if Rush Limbaugh 10 years ago had said, this is what America's campuses are coming to, people would have said, oh, ridiculous scaremongering, paranoia. Remember, you're not paranoid if they really are out to get you. So here's another incident, trampling on a Confederate flag. So there was an incident in which a student college Democrat group at a university had this event where they were trampling on a Confederate flag. Offended students filed charges of attempts to incite violence and create a hostile environment and actions of incivility in violation of the campus speech code. And the university began a months-long investigation of the college Democrats. Well, okay, that's just a joke. Obviously, it's not going to happen. No, this is the real case. This is from San Francisco State University. There's the Hamas flag, and by the way, I use it advisedly, the Confederate flag analogy advisedly. I do know that some people view Confederate flag just sort of as a symbol of modern Southern ethnic pride. To me, it's still a symbol of a country that was organized around the principle of slavery. And when you look at the secession ordinances from various states, they were quite clear in stressing that. So I can see why people are upset by this. I can see why people are upset by the Hamas flag, not just that they're terrorists, but if you really are, if what you all you care about, as my correspondent originally was, is discrimination, this is from the Hamas charter. The Day of Judgment will not come about until Muslims fight Jews and kill them. So the college Republicans at San Francisco State understandably didn't much care for Hamas. So I don't think they bought a flag. I think they drew a copy of the flag and decided to trample on it. Well, it turns out the flag in all of that Arabic writing includes the name of Allah on it. Now, I suspect the college Republicans would have gone on with this even if they had known this. Turns out they didn't know it. But that was the basis for which the university then began a months-long investigation of the college Republicans. And eventually the investigation concluded, and not long after, the entire speech code was struck down by the university. And again, you'd think that a university expressing hostility to a foreign government, this is Hamas is the government of Gaza at the time, it still is, would be obviously permissible, and especially a terrorist government, but even non-terrorist government, surely that's what campus debate should be, among other things, should be about, not in the view of the SFSU administration. This is an incident that hit the news. You may know about it. Speaking of reading books at universities, the horror. This is a book called Notre Dame versus the Klan, How the Fighting Irish Defeated the Ku Klux Klan. So a janitor was sitting at a university in Indiana. Someone complained, and he was officially reprimanded by the employer, the university, because he used extremely poor judgment by insisting on openly reading the book related to a historically and racially abhorrent subject in the presence of your black coworkers. That was enough to impose discipline at a university. This was not ultimately reversed until there was a nationwide firestorm brewed up by the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, which does a very good job in these areas. There's the Laura Kipnis incident from Northwestern, where she was writing an article critical of what she saw as over-enforcement of sexual harassment rules. And students filed the complaints alleging the very publication of an article, essay in the Chronicle of Higher Education, serious publication, was retaliation that violated Title IX. And the Professor Kipnis was investigated for over 2 months. Now, I should say it's just an investigation. She wasn't punished. But as we know, often the process is the punishment. She is somebody who's pretty pugnacious, and more importantly, she is tenured. And when you're pugnacious and tenured, you might not care as much about investigations, although even there it takes effort to deal with it. It saps you of energy, it distracts you from your work. But imagine the message that this is sending to people who aren't tenured, maybe to graduate students, maybe to undergraduate students. So there's the microaggressions thing at UC you may have heard of. Brief, subtle verbal or nonverbal exchanges that send denigrating messages to the recipient because of his or her group membership. And they're labeled one form of systemic everyday racism and can lead to a hostile learning environment. That's an important signal because hostile environments are, in fact, what is prohibited by many university speech codes. So it doesn't formally ban these things, but it signals, again, to people that it is dangerous to say such things. Now, as with many bad ideas, there's a kernel of a sensible point beneath it, which is that people who are especially in the business of trying to inform and teach and persuade should be aware of how it is that what they say, regardless of their intentions, comes across. Our mothers probably taught us this. My mother certainly tried to do that. It took a long time for it to sink in. And if the point is, look, if you say certain things in a particular way, you may be well-intentioned, but people will bristle. People will feel that you're kind of being aggressive towards them. And the result is we won't be as effective at teaching, at persuading, at pushing back the frontiers of knowledge, all the things university is supposed to do. So that makes sense if it were articulated this way. Look, here is advice on how you can more effectively communicate. It would be a very different thing. But it wasn't. Here is what you need to do to avoid racism, to avoid creating a hostile environment, to avoid the things that it's pretty clear will be very institutionally bad for you if you're found to have done. And then, of course, you can speculate about what could be microaggression. You can imagine things. You can be called, again, a straw man builder. But thankfully, the creators of this message did all the hard work for us. Here's some examples. Affirmative action is racist. That's a microaggression. That creates apparently a hostile environment. America is the land of opportunity. Everyone can succeed in the society if they work hard enough. And this is from departments at the University of California themselves. So here is a poster that was put up in January of 2015 at the University of Minnesota. Now, it wasn't put up by Milo Yiannopoulos. It was put up by the University of Minnesota faculty members, tenured faculty members who are organizing this event. If you look at the list of people, this is going to be an academic panel, chock full of academics. The one non-academic is an editorial cartoonist, understandable because this is about satire and free speech after the murders, after the massacre at Charlie Hebdo. And of course, unsurprisingly, on the flyer is a copy of this iconic image, an image that I think will be one of the images of the 21st century, which is the first post-massacre Charlie Hebdo cover, which purports to portray Muhammad. How do you know? How do you know that that's actually Muhammad? But in any event, it purports to portray Muhammad. So this was the poster that was up there. And it turns out that there were complaints brought based on this poster. Now, again, complaints, anybody can complain. You have a First Amendment right to complain. But the complaints went to Kimberly Hewitt, the director of the Equal Opportunity and Affirmative Action Office, who said her office had no choice but to investigate. There are limits on free speech, and that would be where you have harassment of an individual based on their identity, she said. No, by the way, the language, harassment of an individual, makes it sound like somebody, maybe professor, picking on someone in class because of their race or religion. But it's not a harassment of an individual. This is posters put up in the hallways. That was enough to lead her to investigate. Ultimately, she concluded this was not a violation of the policy, but still went out of her way to recommend to the dean that he communicate the college does not support the flyer's image of the Charlie Hebdo depiction of Muhammad. Pleased to report that, as best I can tell, the dean did no such thing. When this can happen to events that are put on by professors, imagine what message that sends to students. Imagine what message it sends to professors who aren't tenured, who don't have the kind of security that that provides. A UVA suspended a lecturer for posting the following thing, I think, on his Facebook feed. Black Lives Matter is the biggest racist organization since the Klan. Are you kidding me? Disgusting. This is not tremendously thoughtful academic inquiry. I don't think it makes sense as a logical matter. I have much that I disagree with the Black Lives Matter movement, but I don't think it's the biggest racist organization since the Klan. And I think if you do think that, you know, this is an argument you should be making, and not just making these assertions. That's what universities should generally be about. So again, if UVA had responded by saying, look, this is a message we disagree with, and it's a message that doesn't seem to be well-reasoned. If you want to debate Black Lives Matter, you certainly should feel free to, but be sensible about it and be thoughtful. This is not sensible or thoughtful. I wouldn't be having this on the slide. No, this is with the Department of Engineering, where the lecturer had a part-time appointment, said. A recent comment has raised serious concerns about UVA Engineering's commitment to diversity, inclusion, and support of underrepresented populations. While free speech and open discussion are fundamental principles, the comment was inappropriate. We don't condone these actions that undermine our values, dedication to diversity, and educational mission. Our faculty and staff are responsible for upholding our values. Mr. Muir has agreed to take leave and is preparing his own statement to the community. We expect our faculty and staff to create a climate that support engages all. This incident has illuminated the need for further dialogue. UVA Engineering must work together to advance a shared vision for a truly inclusive learning community. So a couple of observations. One is further dialogue. This is like, I think it was Bill Clinton who talked about we need to have a dialogue about race around office coolers. It's the dialogue about race around water coolers in the office so we can know who needs to be fired for creating a hostile environment through this dialogue on race. It's ridiculous, and I think it's disingenuous. It's dishonest to claim that what you're trying to do is dialogue when it's perfectly clear that if some people say, well, okay, fine, maybe he said this not very articulately, but let me try to explain it more articulately. It's perfectly clear that that's when they will try to suppress that side of the dialogue. But the broader point is, think about what this means to, again, imagine a graduate student in this department who asks, okay, fine, I want to say something about Black Lives Matter or about some other racially charged issue that is much more detailed and thoughtful. What would the university say? Would it say, no, that's okay. We're not about your views so long as you express them thoughtfully? Not at all. It's perfectly clear from that statement that after all, this criticism, in fact, the more thoughtful criticism, might further undermine the UVA Engineering's diversity, inclusion, and support of underrepresented populations, precisely because it would be more thoughtful and more persuasive. It will further show that you are not upholding the university's values and demonstrating them to students. It will further be something that creates a climate that does not, in UVA's view, support and engage all. The message is perfectly clear. And the message is, shut up. There are lots of other examples of censorship by administrations. University here in LA canceling a speech by Ben Shapiro. UC San Diego provost stressing that there would be that violations of a code of conduct are treated with the greatest seriousness and draw the fullest sanctions. What are the violations? People writing in chalk, build the wall, deport them all, Tritons for Trump. At Tufts University, a student newspaper, the university included, harassed Muslim students by publishing a critical parody of Islamic Awareness Week. And then, of course, there's censorship by thugs. Speech canceled for fear of violence. Speech stopped because of a riot. Speaker shouted down, and then he and the professor who interviewed him being physically attacked. Cal State Northridge, this one did not make the news as much. There was a speaker who was a biographer, apparently an award-winning biographer of Kemal Ataturk, the founder of modern Turkey. Now, Armenians are unhappy with things the Turks have done. I'm not an expert on the subject. My sense is they're quite justifiable in their unhappiness. But what they did, instead of putting on a rival event or whatever else, they basically came in and they shouted down the author, and the speech was canceled. To my knowledge, in none of these cases has there been any real attempt by the university or by police to try to punish the people who are doing this. And the one thing that we've learned in life, as well as in such incidents, is behavior that gets rewarded gets repeated. The message that people are getting is, if you shout people down, the speech will be stopped and you will win. If you have a riot, the speech will be stopped, and you will win, and you'll win more, because that'll be an excuse for stopping other speech as well. This is unfortunately what has been happening on university campuses. Now, let me skip a couple of other things, although I'm happy to get back to it in Q&A, but let me turn to what to do. What to do? Well, I'm an optimist by nature. I think all of us kind of have to be in this room, because otherwise, what's the point? Well, the point is it's lovely out there at Terranea, but that's not really the point. And the fact is, sometimes there is a happy ending. In a lot of these incidents, once there was full pushback, there were people you could draw on within the university who could do the right thing. And some of them because they're afraid of bad publicity, and some of them because they really do want to do the right thing. It's just that there needs to be someone who brings this up to them and takes the time and energy to get their attention. So one thing that could be done is lawsuits. I think Center for Individual Rights, which is another very good public interest law firm in D.C., has had for a while as their tongue-in-cheek slogan, bringing lawsuits for a better America. And I think it was somewhat tongue-in-cheek because I think they realize that lawsuits have their own problems, and many times they make things worse. But some of the times you got to do it. It's got to be done. Now, it won't always work, in part because it can't work at private universities, except in California, where there's a statute that applies free speech protections to private universities. But in other states, all you've got is the First Amendment. The First Amendment doesn't apply by its terms to private universities. And partly because some of this, while I think a serious threat to academic freedom and free speech, is not actually a First Amendment violation. So the moot court problem, I think, was a horrible betrayal of basic academic principles by the administrators that tried to censor the research packet, but I don't think it's a First Amendment violation. I do think that the university is entitled to take these kind of quasi-curricular, not quite curricular, but not completely outside of the curriculum activities, and control it in some measure. I mean, if the dean were to say, look, enough with this whole constitutional law stuff. Most of you are going to be practicing business law. Next problem's got to be a business law problem. I don't think we'd say there's any First Amendment violation there. So lawsuits have their limitations. Public criticism, I think, is very powerful, and here's how I think the internet has helped a lot, is that it becomes much, much easier when people notice this happening for it to be passed along to people who write about it, and then in turn that causes pain for the right kind of pain, the good, the libertarian approved pain for university administrator. There is somebody, some politician, I think Senate Majority Leader back in the day, who had a line. He says, "When I feel the heat, I see the light." But it also requires organized, confident student groups to blow the whistle, and often there aren't. Often the students are too cowed or too disorganized to do that. And it often requires faculty members who can fight back. And unfortunately, in our university monoculture in America, they're often hard to find. But there's hope. There's always hope. A lot of these bad decisions have gotten reversed. Probably a lot of other bad decisions that were contemplated have been stopped by the fear of many of these things. So I'm happy to fight the battle. I know many of you are too. And I think we have at least about 20 minutes or so for Q&A.